Episode 7, Japan's Heist of the Century. In Jukai, those deviating from the main trail typically come across numerous discarded objects, clothing, shoes, food and drink containers. They may find items large or small left behind by someone with suicidal ideations. They commonly find abandoned electronics, tents, and camping gear. One American videographer found a discarded bicycle in perfect shape. Some unlucky visitors find items more gruesome. They may find bloodied neckties used as nooses and tied to trees, or they may see a step stool next to a tree where someone stood and jumped. One of the strangest items frequently found is underwear. Hikers find articles of underwear in the trees and bushes. They sometimes find stained and rotting mattresses. These types of items are typically attributed to the shooting of adult videos or music videos that use the mystique of the forest as a background. One of the strangest items in the forest is a jungle gym. Overgrown with brush and now fenced off, the 30-foot high structure of metal pipes, colloquially referred to as the Jukai Jungle Gym, was a mystery for many years. Adding to its mystique are faded words that translate as research facility. People wondered what kind of research facility would be needed here. Rumors spread that it was a scientist using radio waves to make human brains sick. Others claimed it related to UFOs. The urban legend was finally dispelled. The abandoned jungle gym was found to be related to a research institute that studied the trees at Jukai. The cross-hatched bars allowed researchers to gain a high vantage point without the need to climb trees. But today's episode focuses on one of the most intriguing things that many claim is hidden somewhere in Jukai. Like some pirate's chest, many believe that a stash of cash worth over $3 million was hidden away in one of the caves of Jukai. But the person who hid the money died before using it or disclosing where it is. The cash has never been found. To the Japanese, this mystery is the crime of the century, more famous there than the D.B. Cooper heist or the Black Dahlia murder is in the United States. We study this incredible story and theory in this episode. At 9:15 a.m. on December 10, 1968, four bank employees drive a company armored sedan from the branch manager's house. The bank uses a Nissan Cedric with customized armored to protect the cash. In the trunk, metal boxes contain about 300 million yen, worth about $3 million. This cash is the annual bonus for 4,000. 525 employees of at Toshiba Fuchu Factory. Back in 1968, such bonus transactions were given to employees in cash. The day is rainy and hazy, limiting visibility. As the sedan approaches just a few blocks from its destination, a motorcycle police officer drives alongside their vehicle. He waves at them frantically. Then he pulls in front of the sedan and stops, blocking their path. He raises his left hand, gesturing them to stop. He runs to the driver's side. The surprised driver lowers his window while checking the speedometer. He says, "What's wrong? Was I speeding?"
"I need you to exit the vehicle immediately. I am from Kogane Police Station. We received an emergency call from the Sugamo Police Station that the house of your branch manager has been blown up. The criminals gave us a warning that explosives are planted in this car."
The stunned driver says, "I checked the car but didn't see anything like that." Still, this threat frightens the four employees. They know that on December 6, the branch manager received a threatening letter which read, "If you fail to get a female bank employee to bring 3 million yen to our designated location on December 7 at 5 o'clock p.m., we will blow up the branch manager's house." A female police officer disguised as a bank employee followed the instructions, but the criminal never showed. The bank then warned employees to be on the lookout for anything suspicious. A tense atmosphere descended upon them in the ensuing days. Now, it seems their worst fears are coming true. If the branch manager's house really was blown up, then the criminals could be easily capable of planting explosives in the car. The officer says to the driver,
"It may be attached under the car or in the engine. I need to check. Please get out and stand a safe distance away."
The driver turns off the engine as the four employees scramble out. The four employees move back about 100 feet and watch while the police officer inspects the car. He opens the hood and looks at the engine. Finding nothing, he scoots underneath the car on his back. A moment later, he rolls out from under the car.
"Get back. It's here. It's dynamite. It's going off. Run away. I'll go do this."
They hear him say dynamite, and their blood runs cold. Then they hear a pop and white smoke, and a red flame appear under the car, enveloping it. The four frightened bank employees move farther back, retreating quickly to about 300 feet from the impending explosion. Rather than run away, the police officer throws a number of items on the street near his motorcycle. Meanwhile, a self-defense force officer driving by happens to see the white smoke from under the vehicle. He stops next to the car. He gets out of his vehicle. In his hands, he holds a fire extinguisher. The police officer hesitates no longer. He gets into the driver's seat of the sedan and drives away, leaving behind a startled self-defense force officer and four shocked bank employees. "What a brave police officer," one of the employees states. "He's risking himself so others won't be hurt when it explodes," another concurs, saying, "That's so heroic." The smoke and flames continue to rise from the center of the street. The employees crouch, waiting for the dynamite to explode. The self-defense force officer stands there staring down at it without fear. Finally, after no explosion comes, the four bank employees approach the smoky center of the street. "What's going on here?" the self-defense force officer says. The bank employees see that the pop had been a flare gun, and the red flame and white smoke came from a flare. One of them looks closely at the police motorcycle and finds that it was a regular motorcycle painted white. Shame envelopes them. They realize they have been robbed. The man was no police officer. He was an imposter. Looking around, they see that he stopped them right next to Fuchu Prison. The entire encounter lasted less than 3 minutes. Immediately after stealing the car, the thief makes a right turn, runs a red light, and nearly collides with a large dump truck. He then drives to a cemetery, where he abandons the car and transfers the money into another stolen vehicle. Nearby residents later report to police that a dark blue Corolla had been suspiciously parked there all morning. 10 minutes pass before the employees can finally reach a phone in the prison and call for help. An APB is issued at 9:50 a.m., but the thief is long gone, and the APB is now searching for the wrong car. Having switched cars, the thief is hiding his trail for as long as possible to make a getaway. Meanwhile, police begin an investigation at the scene. The items scattered on the ground by the thief turn out to be 124 pieces of evidence. The thief left these items behind because they were stolen items or mass-produced items that would make it nearly impossible to identify him. He purposely did this to confound the police. The motorcycle had originally been blue, but the thief painted it white, attached megaphones and other items to it so it would look like a police vehicle. He painted a cookie tin to appear like a police box and attached it to the motorcycle with packing tape. The modifications to the motorcycle were so subpar that authorities conclude this was done by an amateur with little knowledge of motorcycles, but it served its purpose. The bank employees were fooled. Investigators discover a hunting cap on the camouflaged motorcycle. From this, they are able to procure dried sweat and determine the blood type of the thief. Under the armored car, the thief had secured the flares with magnets. These fell off along with the flares when he drove off. After changing vehicles at the cemetery, the thief nearly crashes the blue Corolla into a landscaping truck before taking off at breakneck speeds onto the highway. The landscapers, a father and son team, describe the driver as a 20-something-year-old young man with long hair. This conflicts with testimony of the four bank employees who described him as in his 30s. After police find the vehicle he abandoned at the cemetery, they set up checkpoints along major Tokyo roads. This creates heavy traffic jams throughout the city and delays their ability to inspect all the cars. Anticipating this, the thief drives the blue Corolla to a vacant lot at a high school. A local resident later tells police that a strange-looking camouflaged motorcycle had been parked there that morning. Here, the thief abandons the blue Corolla and transfers to a green Corolla stolen on December 1st. He also changes his coat and leaves his raincoat behind. He is in such a hurry that he leaves the door of the blue Corolla open and the windshield wipers on. This is how police will find the vehicle, but many months later, they still have not found the culprit. It is not until 4 months later that police discover where the thief stored three additional stolen cars not used in the robbery. Eventually, police identify up to 100,000 people as suspects. This is essentially the same as having no suspects. They have little in the way of hard evidence, but much in the way of dead ends. They realize it will take time to narrow the list down. their primary suspect was a 19-year-old boy whose father was a police officer. The boy had some expertise with police motorcycles. The boy's close friend previously used flares disguised as dynamite in a supermarket robbery. Given that the boy had no alibi and was skilled at driving both motorcycles and cars, he became the prime person of interest. However, on December 15, before any arrest can be made, the boy commits suicide with potassium cyanide purchased by his father. This only generates further controversy. All who knew him said he was not the type to commit suicide. Even more suspiciously, only his father's fingerprints were found. Conspiracy theorists posited that he was murdered by his father or others to cover their tracks and turn him into a patsy. Police begin to discount him as a suspect when they find that his blood type is different from that found on the hunting cap. His handwriting also does not match the note. If he was involved, there was no way he committed the crime by himself, and police find no money used, hidden, or spent by him that could link him to the crime. With a dead end at every turn, and with too many suspects, police never make any arrests. It was the largest bank heist in Japan history. To this day, it still remains unsolved. The Japanese consider this to be the greatest crime mystery of the 20th century in Japan. The mystery is the inspiration for over 20 novels, and it becomes the source for over 23 movies and television documentaries. It also forms the springboard for countless conspiracy theories. But this intriguing mystery only gets stranger. It is on a collision course with a famous Japanese novelist and Jukai. It is 2 years after the robbery. November 25, 1970, and famous novelist Yukio Mishima, who almost won the Nobel Prize for Literature, knows he only has a few minutes to live. He thinks back. This all began for him at a New Year's party 11 years ago in 1959. At this party, he participates in a kokuri session. This is Japan's version of the spirit board. During the session, he mutters softly in earnest, "The spirit of February 26 has come into me." With this statement, he references the February 26 incident that occurred in 1936. That incident was a failed coup d'état, where young officers rose up against political leaders in an attempt to return power to the emperor and instate extreme nationalist ideals. The young soldiers assassinated several targets, but ultimately failed. After suppressing the uprising, the government prosecutes 124 participants and executes 19 key leaders. Mishima admires these soldiers as revolutionaries, and his statement that night during Kokuri begins a path for him to publicly support extreme nationalist views. 4 years later, and for 3 years straight, including 1963, 1964, and 1965, Mishima is in serious consideration for the Nobel Prize in Literature. But he simultaneously foments support for his extreme politics. He publishes pieces praising those who died in the February 26 incident as dying for their living god, the Emperor. He claims that when Emperor Hirohito renounced his divinity after World War II, he rendered all those deaths meaningless and made himself human when he should be a god. By 1968, Mishima writes plays such as My Friend Hitler. These use historical figures as mouthpieces to express his own fascist and anti-communist ideas. Throughout the decade, he receives hundreds of death threats, sometimes even requiring an armored guard to protect him, but he remains dedicated to the Bushido code of the samurai. An avid weightlifter since 1955, Mishima knows his physical prowess is not enough. Despite his fame, he undergoes military training with Japan's self-defense forces in 1967 and becomes the leading figure in organizing a Japan National Guard. In creating this 10,000-man regiment, he leads right-wing adherents like himself in the hope of overcoming the revolutionary and communist threats against traditional Japan. On February 26, 1968, he brings a number of right-wingers together. They prick their fingers and sign a blood oath promising to die, if necessary, to stop communists and left-wingers. Mishima signs in his own blood by October 1968, which is 2 months before the armored car robbery. Mishima realizes that his National Guard does not have public support, so on October 5, he creates a private militia swearing to protect the Emperor. He calls them the Taotei no Kai, typically translated as the Shield Society. He takes this title from a poem, "From today onward, I stand without looking back as the shield of the Emperor." Starting with about 100 members, his private militia needs one thing: funding. When riots break out on October 21 by the new leftist movement, Mishima believes his militia is necessary, that the people will see this, and that they will succeed in garnering the support they need. The militia suddenly gets surprise funding at the end of 1968, at about the same time as the armored car robbery. Mishima claims the money comes from his personal bank account, but the militia begins to lose momentum over the next year despite this. Half its members abandon the militia during 1969. Mishima says, referring to his failed military campaign, "I can't stand that my children will be laughed at after my death." Though only 44 years old, he seriously contemplates his own death at this time. In June 1969, he creates a will. On the literature side of things, Yasunari Kawabata has just won the 1968 Nobel Prize for Literature. Mishima is happy that a Japanese national wins the prize, but he realizes that it is unlikely another Japanese writer will win for a long time. In May 1970, he hears disturbing news from his translator, Donald Keen. While attending a dinner party in Copenhagen, Keen discovers that the Nobel Committee in 1957 held a meeting in Tokyo. They seem to dismiss Mishima as a serious contender because of his extreme political ideals. They mistakenly label them left-wing communist beliefs instead of right-wing nationalist. Mishima does not find this mistake or the collusion behind the scenes based on politics to be amusing. He now knows he will never win the Nobel Prize. Mishima presses onward with the remaining members of the Tate no Kai, but his thoughts are dark and cynical during 1970. Journalist Henry Scott Stokes reports about a dinner party with Mishima on September 3, 1970.
Mishima started talking darkly again. He says there are many curses in Japan, and they have played a big role in history. He says that the whole of Japan is under a curse. He says, "Japan is under the curse of the green snake." Mishima seems to be sinking into the bitterness of his thoughts. But always the egoist, he will never be a defeatist.
Mishima knows, in a very literal sense of the term, that he must try something big to rally the troops. That day comes on November 25, 1970. After meticulous planning, something he is famous for, Mishima and four others from the Shield Society, between 22 and 25 years old, begin their uprising. Preparations are complete, the time has come. Mishima has an appointment with the commandant at the military base in Tokyo. This meeting will not proceed how the commandant expects. Mishima and his four followers garrison themselves in the commandant's office, blocking the door with desks and chairs. They tie the unsuspecting commandant to his chair. Mishima dons a white headband called a hachimaki, which promotes courage in the wearer. The characters on the front of the headband state, "To be reborn seven times to serve the country," the last words of a famous imperial loyalist samurai in the 14th century. Mishima pushes a paper with four requests under the door to the hallway outside. This paper states that he will kill the commandant if the requests are not met. Soldiers try to push open the barricaded door, but Mishima intimidates and yells at them. He brandishes a samurai sword and cuts them through the crack in the door, pushing them back out. After a second try, the soldiers back out, realizing the commandant's life is in serious danger. They agree to Mishima's request to gather all the soldiers in the courtyard below at noon. They agree not to interfere with him until at least 11 o'clock that night. It is just before noon when Mishima steps out onto the balcony overlooking the courtyard. He throws a white banner with a manifesto over the balcony railing while the soldiers are gathering below. At exactly noon, Mishima steps forward to address the soldiers and a gathering of reporters. Over 1,000 soldiers stand in the courtyard, as promised by the commandant's men. Standing over the crowd, Mishima has no microphone. He projects a booming voice and begins an impassioned speech meant to inspire the soldiers to join him in this uprising to restore the emperor's divine power. He intends to inspire them, thinking they will flock to his cause. Instead, the soldiers below laugh. They meet his speech with jeers and heckling. Above, helicopters responding to the hostage situation are flying overhead. They drown out his word. Mishima's speech is having no effect. He prepared a 30-minute speech, but in the face of this mocking, it turns into a 7-minute farce. The always mercurial Mishima becomes enraged by the response from the soldiers. He cries,
"Where has the spirit of the samurai gone? I can tell you, are not rising up. I have lost my dream."
Then he yells out, three times in his loudest voice, "Tenno Heike Banzai! Tenno Heikei Banzai, Tenno Heikei Banzai, which means long live the emperor. Mishima realizes that his desire to restore the emperor's divinity, strengthen Japan's army, and discard its pacifist post-war constitution will fail. He believes the Western values have encroached too far into Japan, and perhaps have become the green snake poisoning Japan. To Mishima, he sees it all as a cancer. Japan is lost, but perhaps he can make one more symbolic act. He leaves the balcony and returns to the commandant's office. With a bow, he apologizes to the commandant, claiming they had no choice but to try this. It is time to die. Mishima previously claimed,
"Writing is dead to me."
In recent days, he followed up on this, saying,
"Literature is impotent. In the end, you have to act."
Today, he will act. Mishima has never missed a deadline, and at 10:30 this morning, just prior to leaving for the military base, he leaves the final draft of the fourth part of his Sea of Tranquility tetralogy for a courier to take to his editor. A cryptic note to his editor stated,
"This is nothing more than the end of the world."
He is now in the commandant's office with his four compatriots standing guard. With slow formality, Mishima removes his boots, unbuttons his jacket, and pushes down his pants. Now clad only in a traditional Roku Shaku loincloth, he sits on a tatami mat spread on the ground by one of his followers. With him, he carries a briefcase containing two Tanto daggers. He also has the samurai sword used against the soldiers just 30 minutes earlier. Mishima kneels on the tatami mat, taking deep breaths. He is the only one in the room who seems calm. The others shift nervously from foot to foot. Their gazes dart from the door to the commandant tied in his chair, and then back to Mishima. Their hands are shaking. Though just 25 years old, Masakatsu Morita is chosen by Mishima to act as his second, called the Kaishikunin. He also strips to his Roku Shaku loincloth. Morita extracts a dagger and hands it to Mishima with a deep bow. His hands visibly shake, and his nervousness is apparent in every move of his body. But he takes the samurai sword and stands in position behind Mishima, raising the katana above his head and waiting for the right moment to decapitate his leader. Mishima wastes no time. He thrusts the dagger into his stomach less than 2 inches below the navel and cuts 5 inches from left to right. His years of weightlifting play against him. He cannot penetrate far enough for a proper harakiri ritual. His intestines protrude from the wound but do not spill out as they should. The pain is more excruciating than a typical harakiri. Mishima begins toppling forward from the pain. The agony rips his body into convulsions and stiffness, and his legs, which had been bent for kneeling, kick out into a straight line spasmodically. This creates a problem for Morita, who now does not have a clean path for his sword to mercifully decapitate Mishima. He swings down with great force, but his sword does not separate the head. Instead, it wedges into Mishima's right shoulder. Failing to decapitate in one stroke is a disgrace for someone acting as a Kaishakunin. A nervous and now disgraced, Morita raises the sword again. His hands are shaking violently and the sword shakes with them, its tip quivering back and forth. Mishima is now bent forward, writhing in agony with his forehead pressed to the floor. His intestines bulge from his belly. Blood flows from his gut wound, and now it also spurts from the slice of the katana through his shoulder. Morita is openly weeping. He brings the sword down again on the flailing and moaning Mishima. Again, his sword fails to sever the head. This time, it catches part of the neck and the jaw on the left side. He hits an artery. Blood spurts from Mishima's neck, covering Morita and the others, spattering them with gore. The autopsy later shows that Morita hit the carotid artery. Mishima jerks up from the ground in pain. His eyes are open wide with agony. His teeth have bitten into his tongue, from which blood flows down his chin. He has raised his shoulders and scrunched them around his head in pain. This further reduces the length of his neck, creating an even smaller target for the katana. Under a Bushido code, rule called Kubiuchiyaku, a maximum of 3 swings are allowed. After that, they must leave the body for nature to take its course. With this in mind, another of Mishima's followers, named Hiroyasu Koga, steps forward and pushes Morita aside, snatching the katana away from him. He is much larger physically than Morita. Mishima is now starting to fall forward in a state of fainting and half-consciousness. Koga steps up, takes a formal stance, and swings down. With this one last swing, Mishima's head is severed from his neck. Morita, still shaking, kneels next to Mishima's body. "I'm sorry, Sensei," he is saying. Tears flow. He is weeping, reverently. He takes the Tanto dagger used by Mishima and thrusts it into his own stomach. The cut is shallow and weak. He fails to cut through fat or muscle, leaving only a very shallow slice. As Kaishokunin, Morita has always intended to commit harakiri following Mishima's death, but now his disgrace in failing to properly decapitate Mishima brings him further shame. Yet he has just seen his master go through agony that no man should suffer, but Koga is ready. He was previously chosen as Morita's Kaishokunin, and with one clean blow, he slices off Morita's head. Blood has spilled and splattered the office as if a butchery has taken place. The scene is deemed too gruesome for the public, and the government will not allow the media to show any of its photos to the public. One newspaper defies this order and prints a shot of Mishima's decapitated head to get the scoop. Thus ended the Life and Coup attempt of the most popular post-war novelist in Japan. Nobel Prize laureate Kawabata would comic. He died in a wasteful way. Originally, all four followers had intended to commit seppuku with Mishima, but Mishima pleaded with them to abort this plan. Only he needed to die. Three of them acquiesced, while Morita persisted in his loyalty, claiming, "I cannot let Mishima die alone." Even right before his death, Mishima said to Morita, "Morita, you must live on, not die with me." But after his failure as Kaishokunin, whatever plans Morita may have had to survive the ordeal abandoned him. The three survivors surrender and receive 4-year prison sentences. In his last letter to translator Keen, Mishima writes,
"I think you understand what I'm trying to do, so I'll say anything. For a long time, I wanted to die not as a literary man, but as a warrior."
This incident is known throughout Japan and is included in its history books. It is called the Mishima Jiken, meaning Mishima Incident. All high schoolers learn about Mishima's life and death, and they read one or more of his novels in school. As interesting and famous as the Mishima incident is, just what does it have to do with Jukai or the armored car robbery? This is where a prevailing conspiracy theory steps in. To some, Mishima's death also means losing the one and only person who knows where the 300 million yen is hidden. Their theory claims that Mishima is the mastermind of the robbery in December 1968, and the money is still out there like a treasure waiting to be found. According to them, Mishima organized the robbery to fund the Tate no Kai private militia. There is no other explanation for the funding the militia received that coincided with the timing of the robbery. Although Mishima claims that he funded the militia with his personal funds, research showed that his funds were insufficient to finance a large private militia. Yet the amount used for the militia was far less than the 300 million yen stolen, which means that a large percentage of the money is still unaccounted for. Theorists claim, as mastermind, Mishima not only coordinated the robbery but also laundered the stolen money through US military bases. They state that, in 1969, Mishima hid the remainder of the cash in one of the hundreds of caves in Jukai without telling anyone. He did this when he realized that his militia was a failing military campaign. The always plotting Mishima did this secretly, ensuring that he would be the only one who knows where the money is hidden. Then, at some future date, when he revives the momentum of the militia, he can come back for the money. This is what they claim his great plan was, and his call to arms at the military base on that fateful day in 1970 was supposed to be the impetus to revive his cause. The logic behind this theory goes like this. First, Mishima was contemplating his own death in the summer of 1970. Prior to that, the self-defense forces that Mishima was a part of had performed drills and marched through Jukai. Mishima would have known the forest very well through frequent military drills there. Mishima planned every stage of his actions carefully. This was the way he wrote his novels, engaged in weightlifting, and planned his entire life. He never left anything to chance. Not his novels, and certainly not his politics. But if he planned to commit seppuku, if his call to arms at the base failed, why wouldn't Mishima tell someone in his inner circle about the money so that his cause could live on? Some think the green snake he refers to stands for the evils of money, and most believe it at least refers to the American dollar. Perhaps letting the money disappear was a political statement or a final snub to a society that would not support him. Perhaps he told Morita, who then died without passing on the information. No one knows for sure, but Mishima was far from an open book when it came to his political plotting. Just where is the money now? No one knows. It has never been located. If it is hidden in one of Jukai's unexplored caves, no one knows which one it is in. This theory has sufficient traction in Japan that many groups have gone to Jukai searching for the cash. Perhaps someday it will be found. Perhaps this will remain a mystery. Regardless, neither the money nor the robber has ever been found. Thank you for listening to Mysterious Japan. In our next episode, we explore whether Jukai is a haunted forest and examine some of the most famous and supposedly true ghost stories arising from Jukai. As always, please visit our website at www.themysteriousjapan.com for more information. Thank you for making this podcast possible.